The CNBC app. Global market news in one place. Customizable sections and personalized alerts. Stocks tracking, interactive charts and market insights all in your hands. Stay connected. Stay informed. Download the CNBC app today.
Warm welcome to Scorebox. These are your headlines. More talks, little progress. Another round of US aid negotiations failed to reach a deal. CNBC speaks to the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, after he warns an agreement is unlikely before the election.
Getting something done before the election and executing on that would be difficult, just given where we are in the level of details. But we're going to try to continue to work through these issues.
U.S. futures trade lower after blowout earnings from Goldman Sachs failed to cheer Wall Street, as Standard Chartered CEO Bill Winters tells CNBC banks are not on the front line of this crisis.
Banks have come into this crisis with very strong capital positions, and liquidity certainly is not a problem given the central bank action, but also the actions that all of us have taken to shore up our liquidity for just an event like this.
French President Emmanuel Macron imposes a curfew on nine of the country's biggest cities, saying stricter measures are needed to restore control of the pandemic.
If we need to act, it's in order to halt the spreading of the virus. Firstly, to protect others, sometimes ourselves, and to protect the elderly, the most vulnerable, those in the most precarious situations. That's the first objective. Secondly, we need to protect our healthcare systems, our caregivers.
A big hit with investors. Shares in the Korean entertainment group double in their market debut, making millions for headline act and global boy band sensation BTS. So we've got numbers coming out from the global pharmaceutical group Roche. Various flashes, including in the US, overall sales decreasing 4%, but they are saying strong growth of 35% in new medicines, generating sales of 13.7 billion Swiss francs, although sales in their pharmaceutical division decreased 1% to 34.3 billion Swissy as well. Core earnings per share are targeted to grow broadly in line with sales at constant exchange rates. Roche expects to grow its dividend further in Swiss francs. Based on the current assessment of COVID-19 impact, sales are expected to grow in low to mid-single digit range at constant exchange rates as well. Their diagnostics division grew 9%, with COVID testing acting as the main contributor. Well, those are some of the headline flashes. Let's get some more detail now with Juliana. Juliana.
Good morning, Steve. Well, looking at these Roche numbers, there's really two different big themes to pay attention to here. One is in the pharmaceutical division. You mentioned, Steve, that the pharma division saw sales decline 1%. The pharma division, like other pharmaceutical companies, has been hit by the COVID-19 crisis, with a lot of hospital-facing patients affected. So that business coming under a little bit of further pressure. Their diagnostics division, though, growing 9%. So sales in that division have been accelerating, and Roche has been right at the forefront of testing when it comes to COVID-19, with 10 different diagnostics available. So that division growing quite strongly. The main contributor was COVID-19 testing. So two very different impacts being seen here in Roche results. Putting it all together, Roche has confirmed its guidance for the year. That was in line with analyst expectations. Looking through the various analyst notes heading into today's results, the expectation was for that previous guidance of low to mid-single digit revenue growth to be reiterated today. Stable operating margins expected. Now, moving forward for Roche, one of the questions, of course, how much can this diagnostics division continue to grow? And then the pharmaceutical division, how much can new product growth offset the impact of biosimilar erosion? So that's one of the big themes for this stock outside of the COVID-19 crisis. And then one other thing to throw into the mix for the months ahead for Roche is the impact of the U.S. elections. Roche has a substantial U.S. division, so we'll be certainly exposed to any drug pricing reform that comes through on the back of this election. So that's something that Roche investors are going to be paying attention to here. But in terms of the numbers today, no surprise. writes here that the outlook has been reiterated. The pharmaceutical division has been hit, but diagnostics has been growing and has been offsetting that impact in the pharma division. Steve?
Question for you, going backwards and looking forwards, Juliana, because we were all very excited when we thought that there was some form of game changer, as the UK Prime Minister once put it, in antibody testing. And Severin Schwan came on our channel several times to talk about his excitement about the products that were being offered by the company and indeed others in the industry then as well. It proved to be a false dawn and a false hope, and actually it's been a bit of a damp squib for our progress in tackling COVID-19 as well. What are the hopes that the product offering from the likes of Roche going forward are going to be any better at proving to be game changers than false hopes were for antibody tests?
Well, Steve, I definitely agree that the antibody tests have been a bit of a damp squib here, given that we still don't have enough information about how antibodies work with this virus, how much immunity they provide, and how long that immunity lasts. But Roche has a very broad suite of testing available for COVID-19. They've got a PCR test available, which is the most definitive type of test that detects the virus. They've also now got this rapid antigen test, which detects the virus very, very quickly. Not quite as sensitive as the PCR test, but still a really helpful tool. So putting all of these tools together, these are all aids to helping control the outbreak. And as you hear from medical experts across the world, testing is the key. So Roche is sort of, they are involved in every step of the testing process, from the most definitive PCR test to the rapid antigen test, both which detect the virus. And then they do have the serological antibody tests, which do detect immunity. But the bottom line with all of this testing, these are tools. And ultimately, we do need a vaccine to have any broad solution to the crisis. But testing, all these testing tools that Roche has been providing are key to helping control the outbreak.
Just a quick Steve? One. How concerned should our viewers be that from AstraZeneca to Eli Lilly to Johnson & Johnson, there seems to be stuttering progress in phase 3 trials? This is to be expected, we hear from the pharmaceutical industry. But is there any cause for concern over the longer term hopes for a product?
It's too soon to say, I think, Steve, whether these pauses that we've seen now come in through Johnson & Johnson and Eli Lilly, and of course AstraZeneca previously, will be very substantial roadblocks to getting these various drugs and vaccines through. The message certainly is from the medical community that these types of pauses are extremely normal. The difference here is that the world is watching, but each of these events needs to be treated differently, and we're still waiting for more information when it comes to Eli Lilly and Johnson & Johnson, as well as AstraZeneca in the US.
Absolutely, Juliana. Look, we appreciate your expertise. We're very lucky to have you as a former, what do you call yourself, chemicals rather than pharmaceuticals analyst?
Chemicals, so a neighboring industry.
Yeah, we're just very glad you didn't get big tech when you were an analyst.
Listen to CNBC's Beyond the Valley, the podcast that explores the biggest tech news from across the globe. Join me, Arjun Karpal.
And me, Tom Chitty, every week as we bring you insights into the top stories, unpack the latest trends, and find out where the industry is headed.
Now available on Spotify, Apple Music, and Google Podcasts.
US Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin has dampened the hopes for a speedy stimulus package, saying an agreement before the November election will be difficult. Mnuchin and the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, spoke once again but failed to strike a deal. The Treasury Secretary said they are, quote, far apart on some of the key issues.
There are money issues. There's also policy issues. The bill that the House passed is close to 1,600 pages. The importance is in the details. We're going through language. One of the things that's very important to us is making sure that we have liability protection for small businesses and for schools as they reopen. There's lots of significant issues here.
And if you can't get enough of Steve Mnuchin, we're going to speak to him again today. There you go. 14:30 CET, CNBC will speak to Steve Mnuchin, the US Treasury Secretary. Elsewhere in administration, the economic advisor Larry Kudlow advocated for the administration's piecemeal approach to reaching a fresh stimulus deal, arguing there is more time to negotiate a comprehensive package.
Why go all or nothing? Why not just agree to a few simple principles and litigate the rest of it later on? You've got plenty of time. I'm just saying that right now, right in here, you have a moment where I think you could come together in a sensible, targeted, efficient, smart package. And that's what Secretary Mnuchin is trying to do.
I bow to the knowledge of all my friends and investors and viewers stateside, but have you ever had a more packed political agenda with the hearing for Amy Coney Barrett as well, and the 11 hours of grueling context there, the build-up to what is one of the most hotly contested elections for decades, plus you've got stimulus package talks ongoing as well. Capitol Hill is a busy, busy place. Right. In the meantime, though, the market's just taking a little bit of a pause for breath. Actually, we had a four-day rally. Now we've had a two-day downtick on some of these indices as well. It was across the board, really. For instance, in the Dow, United Healthcare was one of the biggest decliners there. But more broadly on U.S. indices, consumer discretionaries were falling as well. Plus, the news out of the banking sector, we'll come to that in a few moments' time, really extraordinary numbers out of some of these banks. And by and large, the likes of JP Morgan, Citi and Goldman's doing incredibly well. More concerns elsewhere, perhaps, are the likes of Wells Fargo. Again, we'll come to that in a few moments' time. Let's have a look at the transports as well. My producer, Anna, was particularly excited about this one today. 9% up year to date, the Dow transports. Well, what she was particularly excited about is we've got a record high on the Dow transports again, which I think is actually very interesting. And I'm glad she drew my attention to it as well, because the transports very often seen as a metaphor for broader America as well. And if we are seeing some form of recovery that does have legs, and there are big questions about whether the recovery does have legs or not, Dow transports will undoubtedly be there if there is a broader recovery as well. Interesting to note from yesterday as well, the producer prices. Just a hint, and I go, I'm not the first one to augur inflation returning in any meaningful way in the States, but just a hint of inflation coming through in the September figures for producer prices compared with the August numbers. Actually, a big increase there. What have I got for you? Year-on-year core PPI going up by 1.2%, up only 0.6% in August. So, you know, maybe the first flashes of interest there. Anyway, other indices that will need to rally if we are going to see a broader US market, and that's include the Russell 2K, which you can see on your screen there, which was down 0.9%. Bank of America missed third quarter revenue forecast. Low interest rates weighing on lenders' margin. If any of you were in any doubt about the slavish relationship between the two, the five and the 10-year paper compared with the profitability of banks, well, you should dispel that rumor now, throw it away, put it in the trash can as well, because it is seriously affecting margins for these banks. The bank set aside, though, $1.4 billion in loan provisions, down from $5.1 billion in the previous period. Meanwhile, Goldman Sachs comfortably beat on the top and bottom line after the bank reported a strong performance at its bond trading and asset management units in the third quarter. Let's take a look at what the US bank stocks did yesterday. Goldman's barely moved, but I have to say the return on equity was quite extraordinary there. JP Morgan giving it back a little bit of ground. Citi also down 1.5%. Bank of America is where we saw the real pain, down 5.3%. Cole Smead is president of Smead Capital Management as well. Cole, we're learning a lot about the bank's sustainability and indeed where they stand amid this crisis. What's your broad brush take so far from the four or five big banks we've seen?
Yeah, the banks that have the biggest capital markets activities are the ones that look to most investors to have the most diversification. I think the only catch with that, Steve, is if you went out to the likes of a Goldman or a Morgan Stanley and asked them how their pipeline looks, they would tell you it looks wonderful between the SPACs that are going on and their ability to raise capital. The only problem is when those pipelines look as good as they do, what's going to come next? In other words, what's going to be their encore? So I say that because if you look at the commercial and consumer banking end of the arena, you know, the likes of Wells Fargo or more so Bank of America compared to JP Morgan and the big investment banks, those are kind of the poor stepchildren in the mix right now. And I highlight that because you were mentioned on the PPI numbers. I think the most interesting number the last 2 days was the CPI numbers that your colleague Phil LeBeau reported on. If you look at the new car sales here in the United States, they were up 1% month to month, but used car sale prices were up 6.7% month to month. Okay, we're having a classical economic recovery in the United States led by autos and housing, and that bodes incredibly well for the economy. And I think people are underwhelming how important that is to the recovery that is incredibly strong. despite the fact, as Mnuchin and Pelosi would tell you, we're nowhere near getting this deal.
Cole, you and I have had a great debate. In fact, this very same debate, pre-COVID as well, COVID. So let's renew this for our viewers as well. Let's give them something to talk about as well. This is not a classical economic recovery in the 90s. And I take your point about the auto sales, and I'm glad they've managed to put their price up and improve their margins, because quite frankly, OEMs have had zilch margins, as you and I both know, on auto sales. They get their money from all the additional services as well. But this is not a classical economic recovery. If it was a classical economic recovery and going great guns, we wouldn't be crying out for $1.5 to $2.5 trillion coming out of stimulus from Capitol Hill.
Steve, your point is right in that we're crying out for stimulus. But if you compare this to 2009, this is a pittance relative to 2009. The households of America were in the worst position in the history of the United States of America. And in that case, they had the highest debt service ratios in the history of the data. If you look at that same data point right now, we are at the lowest debt service ratios among households in the 40 years the Fed's tracked the data. Okay, so to your point, who got caught in this pinch was businesses, no question about it. But if you look back to the 2009 recovery, autos and homes never recovered. Okay, so I say it's classical because if you look at like the 81, you look at the early recession in the 1980s, you had autos and homes move in the 1980s coming out of that. We never saw that in 2009, okay? We never threw money at this problem like we are now in 2009. We never did it. We're going to do more stimulus post-World War II than anything we've ever seen. And yet we had a deeper recession in 2009. Okay. So I'm very interested in the fact that the economy is rebounding in highly cyclical areas. And we want to throw even more money at the problem. Okay. So why are used cars going up in value? Because nobody wants to take transport. Well, that means consumer preferences are changing quicker than the government numbers are showing.
Cole, and after the last time we had this debate, I looked at those household numbers and that, and I bow to your knowledge on that, and you were spot on. So I'll give you that one hands down as well. My second piece of evidence, though, if this was a classical economic recovery with a big increase in cyclicals, why has the most powerful central bank in the world said, you know what, I'm not even going to touch interest rates for the next 3.5 years. You can run inflation hot because that's how worried I am until the end of 2023. Yeah. If this was classical, you wouldn't be having trillions of dollars of stimulus and you wouldn't have a central bank which is terrified of raising rates even 0.25%.
Yeah, no, Steve, that is the most common question someone points out to me. They'll say, but Cole, if trouble arises for markets, let's just say, you know, won't the Fed be there to bail us out no matter what? Because, you know, that's what they've done so far. A couple of days ago, one of the Fed governors mentioned that there is no forward commitment. In other words, they're providing a lot of liquidity now, but they guarantee nothing in the future. And I thought that was interesting because that didn't get much play or press for that matter. Okay. So, you know, Greenspan was known for putting, you know, for being the put to markets, okay? But do not kid yourself, when 99 broke, Greenspan didn't matter. Markets cleared on their own. And I think that's the real thing that people are missing. My gut feeling, Steve, is that we peaked this thing in September. We ain't going to go back to that number. We got about 150 basis points away from it earlier this week. And what have we started doing? Markets started looking sloppy the last couple of days, okay? The buying that went on in August and September is a 10-year phenomenon, the likes which we've never seen among millennials, and then the risk-taking among people that don't want to own bonds and want to own overpriced U.S. quality businesses is of record proportions. And the question is, are markets going to get rectified regardless of the Fed? And I would argue markets are going to clear because the Fed has really helped credit markets, but they can't save a stock market. And I think that's the biggest problem.
I love this debate and I love you challenging me and I love me challenging you. So just take this in the spirit it's meant as well, because I do enjoy this debate. Those people who are buying stocks in August and September, are you happy that they are buying these stocks on 22 times forward S&P compared with the 10-year average of 15%? They are paying up to 50% higher for the value of those same stocks. And don't get me wrong, I appreciate some cracking good companies out there, but I'm being asked as a US investor to pay 50% higher than the 10-year average. Is that good?
It's a nightmare. It's a total nightmare. I'll give you a term, Steve, that we're talking a lot about with clients and investors. stock market failure. It never gets higher. Okay. So to your point, the two forms of that failure are millennials, and it's people my age, you know, in their 30s and early 40s that are speculating in the stock market for the first time in their lives. What are they doing? They're buying bullish call options that expire inside of 2 weeks. The number on it was there was $500 billion of bullish call options bought in a 4 week stretch by small retail traders. In 99, it was only 100 billion. In 07, it was 100 billion. So that's what young, dumb investors are doing. And when the market makers get those, see those out there, those call buying, they sell that call to that person and they buy the stock. Much of the stock buying in August was nothing more than market makers hedging their you know, the call rights they were doing. But in boomers out there, baby boomers are people of wealth, the willingness to ride the index to a fault and overpay for great American businesses like a Costco or like a Microsoft, the only problem, to your point, Microsoft is a wonderful company, but at 40 times earnings, there is a 0% chance of that producing wealth for someone over the next 10 years that will meet their needs.
We've got to leave it there. I hear you, my friend. And actually, we found somewhere we completely agree on as well. I was an option market maker for 11 years and watching people buy these calls, expecting them to make money, even on modest inclines. As you say, young and dumb. There's no other way for
it. Incredible. It'll be fun, Steve. Thank you.
Cole, always a good chat, my friend. Thank you very much indeed for that. You stay well. Cole Smead, president of Smead Capital Management as well. Standard Chartered CEO Bill Winters has told CNBC exclusively that the global banking system was in good shape ahead of the coronavirus outbreak and that central bank support means many lenders have already absorbed their losses. Mr. Cutmore's not here because yesterday he was working very hard. He's working very hard this afternoon as well, talking to the Standard Chartered boss in the afternoon and asked him if he still saw any risks to the recovery from the financial sector.
There's extraordinary central bank support for the financial system broadly, and I think that applies to the large banks in each market as well. Banks have come into this crisis with very strong capital positions, and liquidity certainly is not a problem given the central bank actions, but also the actions that all of us have taken to shore up our liquidity for just an event like this. So I think the financial system is really in very good shape. And as we've seen, at least so far, and you've seen a number of U.S. banks report in the last couple of days, there's been a material tapering off in the credit impairments, which, of course, this is following a period of a real spike in impairments. But it says to me that, at least for those banks that have reported, they were in front of the loan losses that are likely to come. Material though they are, they're manageable. They've been absorbed, and now it's time to move on. So I don't think that the banking system itself is poses much of a risk to the recovery.
There is a fear among some that even as we looked at some of those earnings, Bill, and we saw that even in the consumer banking area, they weren't terrible numbers. There is a concern among some, though, that we are waiting for another shoe to drop in terms of the full impact of continued loss of jobs and concerns about ability to meet debt obligations, whether that be credit card debt or mortgage debt. Are you in that camp, or do you take a more positive view?
Well, we heard the comments from Fed Chairman Powell about the need for stimulus to sustain the recovery in the U.S., and I'm sure that was a very clear statement, very deliberate, and obviously targeted at a deadlocked Congress in the U.S. But I think that's the case across the board. I mean, we're clearly getting into a phase of, we could call it a second wave or an extension of the first wave or whatever you want to call it. I'm sure we'd rather not call it anything. That will require some element of ongoing fiscal support if we're going to avoid something of a cliff effect in terms of job losses and the consequent impact on consumption. So I think governments do have an opportunity or an obligation it would be helpful. I mean, you can characterize it how you'd like to carry on through this next phase of this pandemic. But it may not happen. And it may not happen for some understandable reasons. I mean, some countries feel fiscally very stretched, even despite the fact that we've got very, very low interest rates. That doesn't seem to be the conventional wisdom or the wisdom in any of the major economies, though, where I think we can expect some government support to persist. And against that backdrop, I think the underlying momentum for a recovery can continue to grow.
Thank you for listening to Squawk Box Europe Express.
For more market-moving news, you can head to CNBC.com.
Or join us again on the show with Jeff Cutmore, Steve Sedgwick and Karen Cho, weekdays on CNBC.